Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, a show where we try to make concepts of electronic discovery accessible to anyone that's interested at a price everyone can afford, which is free at time when they're available. Instead of having to travel to a conference and hear national speakers, you can listen to it on your iPod when you have time or on your computer. That's our goal, and real excited to have today the founder involved with the Sedona conference, which almost every speaker we've had thus far at ESI Bytes has been a member. So I think it's time to define the Sedona conference and talk a little bit about what Sedona is up to. Richard Brayman is our guest. Since 1998, Richard has been serving as executive director of the Sedona Conference, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the advancement of law and policy in the areas of antitrust law, complex litigation, and intellectual property rights. In addition, Richard, and I find this very interesting, was a founder and operator of a nationally renowned Twin Cities jazz club featuring national and international talent, and he remains active in the local jazz scene. Richard, thanks for joining us here on ESI Bytes.
My pleasure, Carl.
And let's jump right in and, you know, tell me the story of the Sedona Conference. What is it? How did it get started?
Well, I founded the Sedona Conference in 1997. Didn't get off the ground really till 1998. But the reason behind it was I had been a speaker at a number of CLE programs and was always disappointed to see the number of people in the room doing crossword puzzles, reading newspapers, or going out to play golf, and thought it a waste of mental energy and time for people to be passively collecting CLE credits. So the idea was to create a conference that would present advanced legal education for experienced practitioners and leading jurists and other experts from around the country and world that would be in a setting with a large faculty that was balanced in terms of plaintiff and defense lawyers, members of the bar, experts where appropriate, and a limited participant base to no more than 45 experienced lawyers and others, so that they could engage in dialogue instead of passively listening to lectures. And the whole concept was to have dialogue-based programs. When we began in 1998, the mantra was we wanted to transcend traditional legal education. And our conferences were in the areas you mentioned, complex litigation, antitrust law, and intellectual property rights. After about 3 years of doing those conferences in Sedona, Arizona, advanced learning in a panoramic setting was our tagline, we found that the bench and bar just wrapped their arms around the dialogue concept. And we found that new ideas always came out of the room after a day-and-a-half program that didn't exist beforehand. By asking people to leave their little red wagons at the door, to just bring their intellectual ambition and curiosity into the room, and with a variety of perspectives and viewpoints, address leading-edge issues so that by the end of the program, new ideas, collective wisdom, came out of the dialogue that didn't exist beforehand. And starting around 2002, we were searching for a way to bring the benefit of that dialogue to the broader bench and bar. One of the Sedona rules that allowed the dialogue to be candid and encouraged excellent interchanges was that what's said in Sedona stays in Sedona, and Sedona is wherever we happen to be. So because of that, we couldn't simply tape record our proceedings or video them or transcribe them and shoot those out to the bench and bar. So we need to come up with a different way to bring the wisdom that came from the dialogue to the broader bench and bar. And the concept we hit upon was to develop a series of working groups or mini think tanks that would be tasked with a mission to address a leading-edge area of the law that might have been unclear in terms of case law. There might have been a dearth of case law, or where other, for other reasons, practical guidance was needed to help move the law forward in a reasoned and just way. And in the spring of 2002, in a complex litigation conference, we were addressing issues related to ESI and electronic discovery. And that was an area that in 2002 there was very little case law, and the case law that was out there did not necessarily provide clear guidance to practitioners or their clients. And so the very first working group we formed was our working group on electronic document retention and production, and that was formed in the summer of 2002, and they had their first meeting of, I think, 35 people in October 2002. which led to the production of the Sedona Principles addressing electronic document production in March of 2003. A month later, the Sedona Principles were cited by the Civil Rules Committee Discovery Subcommittee as one of four reasons for potential rules amendments in the area of electronic discovery. A month after that, it was cited by the now infamous Zubelake decision out of the Southern District of New York. And since then, the Sedona Principles have become a household name. And since that time, we've also started up working groups in the areas of antitrust and intellectual property rights and other areas in the complex litigation field with the idea of using the dialogue concept, making sure we have a balance of views and perspectives to create content in the form of principles, guidelines, or best practices, all designed to move the law forward in a reasoned and just way.
Well, it's been very effective. Acknowledge that virtually every guest we've had on thus far was either a judge with a strong opinion and have been active in Sedona, such as Judge Shindlin and Judge Bacciola, or they're in that original group of 35. So you truly have done a great job producing thought leaders, which is important. How did you personally become interested in e-discovery? Was it through the Sedona experience or?
Well, it was through looking at the state of the law in 2002 and hearing the frustration of practitioners, clients, and judges in terms of how to deal with the increasing volume of information that needed to be exchanged in the discovery process and the lack of guidance in terms of how to define what gets produced, how it gets produced, and when things like cost shifting might be appropriate, because for many lawyers, getting out of the paper world was a new experience, but they still needed to find a way to get cases prepared and ready for trial that was cost-effective and consistent with Rule 1 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And the advancements in technology led people to realize that electronic information was, number one, extremely voluminous, number two, extremely distributed in a manner that paper matter usually isn't distributed, and created unique issues that the law hadn't yet fully addressed, and there was just a lack of guidance out there. And given that our mission is to move the law forward in a reasoned and just way, it seemed like an ideal first issue for us to attack through the Working Group Series program.
Well, if you're looking backwards, and sometimes it's nice to look backwards, what would you say are the Sedona Conference's most important contributions to date from your perspective?
Well, to me, far and away, the most important contribution is introducing the concept of dialogue to lawyers and judges. We're all trained in law school to be advocates, to argue a position, to win a debate, to win a point, to marshal our own case in a way that defeats the other side, a zero-sum game. And our approach to legal education, as well as to creating content, is to acknowledge that no one person has the right answer, that together people with different viewpoints and different perspectives, if they are engaging in dialogue and not debate, can actually come up with the best possible answer to a solution instead of simply winning your side. And it's that concept of dialogue that makes our conferences so fruitful in terms of producing new ideas and new thoughts, and that concept of dialogue carries out into any number of areas of one's professional practice, whether you're on the bench or in the bar or working for a corporate client. And it's more a way of living and behaving than it is subject matter specific. And I think that introduction of dialogue into our profession is the single most important contribution the Sedona Conference has made to date.
Okay, great. Now let's look forward. What we're going to talk about in a little bit more detail now is the Sedona Conference's cooperation proclamation. Tell me a little bit about that, and how did it come about?
The genesis of the cooperation proclamation goes back just about 2 years ago today. This is about our two-year anniversary. I was fortunate enough to be on a panel called the Data Deluge Summit that was hosted at Georgetown in March of 2007. And There were, I think, 13 different panelists, including Justice Breyer, Judge Facciola, whom you mentioned, and others. And the point of the summit was to address the data deluge that ESI has brought to American business and thus to American litigation, and how to make sure that the data deluge doesn't break the system and leave the courts as a playground for the wealthy, but leaving others outside of the door because it has become too expensive to exchange facts in the course of discovery. And during that panel, I made the suggestion at one point that if opposing counsel could learn how to be non-adversarial in the fact-finding process and to save their adversarial skills for litigating the accuracy of the facts produced and the impact of the law on those facts, what lawyers are trained to do in law school, but to be cooperative in the fact-finding process, that was one of the only ways to get through the data deluge in a way consistent with Rule 1 and to reduce the what was becoming the ever-growing and burdensome costs of discovery in the pretrial phase of litigation. When I made that comment, the moderator of the panel said that was utopian and we'd need to save further discussion on that to the second half of the panel. We never got back to it. But the utopian comment bothered me because I didn't really think it utopian. I thought that cooperation and fact-finding, meaning candid communications with one another, forthright exchange of facts, etc., was definitely not utopian, and in fact something that the rules contemplated ever since they were enacted back in the 30s, that the recent enactments and or amendments to the rules of federal procedure in the 90s and most recently in 2006 ever and more clearly mandated cooperation in the discovery process. The case law mandates cooperation in the fact-finding process, and perhaps most fundamentally, our obligations, ethical and professional, as officers of the court, demanded the kind of candor and forthright sharing of information that the cooperation proclamation calls for. So about a year after that summit, we prepared the Sedona Conference Cooperation Proclamation. We had input from our Judicial Advisory Board and from others to help craft the document. And it really is a call to action. It was meant to be short, but part of a three-stage process. The Cooperation Proclamation itself is saying why it is important for lawyers to be cooperative in the fact-finding process, how it is consistent with their ethical obligations to represent their clients, and also consistent with their obligations to the court and their duty of candor, and how it was the only way to get through litigation today in a way that was cost-effective and, again, consistent with Rule 1. The proclamation was originally published in July of 2008, and then in the beginning of October 2008, we had 20 different judicial endorsements of the Cooperation Proclamation, held our first virtual press conference in about the second week of October. And a week after that, the first case to cite the Cooperation Proclamation, the Mancia decision by Judge Grimm, came out, which set forth what I've mentioned as the mandate for cooperation in the rules and in the common law and in our ethical obligations. And since then, it's been cited by another five or six courts, which are all listed on our website on the Cooperation Proclamation page. If you go to www.thesedonaconference.org, on the homepage, you'll see a section dedicated to the Cooperation Proclamation and get a link to a page that follows our efforts in that regard. What's important about the Cooperation Proclamation is that it doesn't stop with the call to action. It's not enough just to ask or suggest that lawyers need to be cooperative in the discovery process without giving them the tools to actually actualize the ability to behave cooperatively, because it's really calling for a behavior change. I've been a practicing lawyer for 30 years, and I'm fully cognizant that this calls for a behavior change. So in addition to the proclamation itself, there are two follow-on steps that we're in the middle of working on right now, and we label the steps ACT for ACT, because we are calling on people to act and to change their behaviors. Part one is awareness, and that's the call to action represented by the Cooperation Proclamation itself. Part two is labeled commitment, and we are working right now on what we call the case for cooperation, which is basically a Brandeis brief type document designed to demonstrate the common law, the rules, requirements, excuse me, and the ethical obligations of a lawyer to behave cooperatively. In other words, as in the Mancia case, all the reasons why you need to behave cooperatively to fulfill your obligations as a lawyer, to fulfill your obligations to the court, to the system, to your client, and to get through the pretrial discovery process in a way that allows matters to be resolved on their merits and not let the discovery tail wag the dog. And then the third part is tools, developing a series of guidances for the different stakeholders in the system, the bench, in-house counsel, litigators, mediators, to show them different ways, different guidances, if you will, to help them actualize cooperation in their practice as they're working on a matter. And we hope to have both the case for cooperation and the various sets of guidances for the different stakeholders all completed by the end of this calendar year. So it goes far beyond simply saying cooperation is necessary. We want to provide the means that will allow the different stakeholders to actually achieve and realize cooperation in their practice.
You know, this is, from anyone who's worked in this field, you recognize that it's real important. Otherwise, it's just very expensive. These things, if you're fighting over electronic data, it's just too complicated. Data is all over the place. There's too much of it. The battles can get very, very expensive. But I was at a conference in Georgetown a couple of years ago, too, and talking to Judge Facciola and a couple of other people about what happens when you get parties of different size in litigation. And I threw out a basic comment, you know, it's one thing to cooperate when everyone's the same size. Do you do the same thing when the party's smaller? And here's what the reaction I got was snickering loudly from the entire audience, which was mostly large law firms, okay, and large companies. Okay, so we did a show on a BNA audio broadcast called David versus Goliath, and I think Georgetown's done a similar program. Since I've done that, I've worked with smaller law firms to talk about this issue, and they snicker back because they realize that oftentimes they have the advantage because they don't have all the data. So collaborating when both sides are going to feel the pain is one thing. Have you looked at all about collaboration when you've got different, you know, economic backgrounds and different amounts of data?
Yeah, I'd like to do what I can do to dispel the myth of asymmetrical litigation and how it impacts cooperation generally and discovery specifically. The David and Goliath situation, typically referred to as it's easy to ask for everything in the world. It's difficult and expensive if you're the data owner to respond to that information, and so there's no motivation for the requesting party to be reasonable in their request. Let me address that in a couple ways. First of all, the rules themselves require that your discovery request be reasonable, and obviously ever since their inception, you can object if it's unduly burdensome. There's a requirement that your request be proportional to the matter at issue in the litigation, and those obligations need to be lived up to. But on the cost side, obviously the data owner in asymmetrical litigation is the one that has to take a lot of steps to collect, to preserve, and ultimately to produce information in discovery. But that doesn't mean it's cost-free to the requesting party, whether it's a solo practitioner or a small law firm or a large law firm who's representing a client that doesn't have the same volume of data as the large data owner. There are costs on those parties as well. Usually in that type of asymmetrical litigation, the party without the data, a plaintiff in a class action, for example, while that firm doesn't have the same amount of data to look for and collect and produce, they certainly have the need to review what is produced and to marshal that information into their case. And if you're a contingency fee lawyer, you don't want to get more than you need. you're expending your time, your costs, and your expenses over frequently a number of years before you get to verdict, let alone ultimate payment. And not every case you file results in ultimate payment. So you have the same motivation as the producing party does to keep costs down, to shorten the time from request to receipt to trial, as do the producing parties. And the cost that you're expending in reviewing the data, if you've asked for too much, get out of control, whether it's the investment of time that you're making or the investment in technology to review the information you receive. So personally, I don't view the David and Goliath situation as one that presents a disconnect in motivations to cooperate. I think the same motivations are there.
Well, those are good points. Well, we'll look forward to seeing this project continue to develop and the tools come out. This is, I think, obviously a very good idea that hopefully will be embraced as well as some of the previous initiatives of the Sedona Conference. Are you looking to find more people to join the Sedona Conference? And why don't you talk a little bit about the process of being a member?
Sure, and before I get to that, the one last point I want to make about the Cooperation Proclamation, I mentioned that by our press conference in October, we had 20 judges that had endorsed it. We republished it again in January of 2009, updating our list of endorsements. We now have 48 judges, state and federal, from 17 different states, that have endorsed the Cooperation Proclamation. And the reason that we've asked judges to endorse the Cooperation Proclamation is that in a lot of ways, this might be a top-down motivation generator, if you will. If lawyers and their clients understand that cooperation and discovery is what is expected by the courts, as well as required by the rules and the law and our ethical obligations, it's more likely they'll begin to change their behavior to work cooperatively. And we expect that list of endorsements to simply grow and grow, and we have more endorsements to post. We're just waiting to update that posting. But that was a sideways comment to your question. The Sedona Conference is...
To finish out that string, so your strategy is to let this germinate is discuss it in a small group, get some experienced, varied practitioners working on developing documents and toolkits that explain why this is important, and get judges to buy into it. Is there anything else that you're looking to help germinate this idea? Because it's fascinating how you get an idea in the marketplace.
Once we do the case for cooperation, the legal underpinnings and the ethical underpinnings for why you need to behave cooperatively in fact-finding, the guidances for the different stakeholders that I mentioned will be developed. The next step after that is to take those guidances on the road and engage in a series of educational exercises to help educate the bar and the bench in terms of how to best achieve cooperative behavior consistent with your twin obligations to the court and to your client. So it's not going to stop simply with preparation of the written content. It's also going to be interactive educational programs as well. And we don't expect this kind of change to occur overnight. It might take a decade. It might take a generation, but it will happen.
Okay. So now about Sedona, how do you get involved? Are you looking for people?
We're always looking for people, just like the Marines, I guess. The Sedona Conference itself is a nonprofit 501c3 nonpartisan nonprofit law and policy think tank. Our mission, as mentioned earlier, is to move the law forward in a reasoned and just way and the areas of antitrust, intellectual property rights, and complex litigation. And we really depend upon our volunteers and their pro bono effort to create the content, the guidelines, the principles, and best practices that help move the law forward in a reasoned and just way and get cited by the courts, and that's the way our common law develops. So the Sedona Conference as an organization is open to anyone to join as a member of one of our working groups. We now have 7 up and running. They're listed on our website. To become a member of one of our working groups, there's an application on the website and simple directions on how to join. Working Group 1, the one on electronic document retention and production, as I mentioned, began with about 35 members in 2002 and has over 600 members right now. And those working groups have a special members-only area that once you become a member of a working group, you get to get early access to draft works in progress by those working groups in terms of creating content, to offer your comments, edits, and suggestions to help improve the work product, because we believe in collective wisdom. And then each working group has at least an annual meeting each year, and sometimes in the case of very active working groups like the one in electronic document retention and production, we actually have a couple meetings each year to further engage in face-to-face dialogue designed to move the law forward. We also have a number of conferences open to the general public, whether or not you're a member of the Sedona Conference, that carry the dialogue concept out in terms of an educational environment. Our what we call our regular season conferences, the three each year in our three subject matter areas, typically held in Sedona, and then what we call our Sedona Conference Institute programs that are held in major markets around the country and the world, that are designed for a larger group where the dialogue takes place amongst the faculty on the dais more than with everyone, because those are open to 150 participants. It's a pretty large room to have dialogue in, but the dialogue does still take place. So you can become involved simply by going to one of our programs, or you can listen to one of our webinars, or you can join a working group if it's of a particular interest to you, and actually help us create the content that will help move the law forward ultimately. And again, all that information is available on the homepage of our website, thesedonaconference.org.
Great. Well, I appreciate you joining joining us for the show and sharing this information. Hopefully we can help you push this along through the power of the Internet. And so you've listened to another edition here of ESI Bytes. If you're interested in future shows or past shows, you can go to our website at www.esibyteswithay.com. We're all about trying to keep education out there so you don't get bit by e-discovery, but you're learning about it. So, again, Richard, thanks for joining us. This is Carl Schinneman from Jurnov, and thanks again. Take care.
Thank you, Carl, for the opportunity.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.